been good to be here for the weekend. I hope you guys have enjoyed it. Or maybe I hope you haven't. I don't know, maybe it's better if you haven't enjoyed it. If you came to the house of laughter, you may have gone home without anything. If you came to the house of mourning, you might go home better. Ecclesiastes. I think we'll go ahead and begin tonight with prayer. Father, thank you so much for all the blessings that you've given. I pray that you would indeed yet speak to the hearts that are gathered here together tonight. There are still two more planned meetings tonight, with this one and Roy speaking again. I pray that you would just take these things that are said, and Father, there are lives here that are growing up, some that are grown up, some that may be doing well, some that may be doing poor, and many that are making decisions right now that are going to affect their children and their friends, for good or bad. I pray that your work would be done this day in our souls. And I pray that you would rescue us from many evil traps that the devil would have us to be in. Amen. We looked last night at the fact that man is prone to always feeling like the grass is greener on the other side of the fence. And because we think that way, because we always view something else in life besides where we are right now as better, we are very prone to change. We like to change because what we have doesn't look as good as what the next person has, or what is newer doesn't look as good as what was older. And we looked at the very complicated subject of change last night, because there is a time and a place that change is good and we should change. And we need to understand when those times are. And there is many a time that we should not change, and we need to understand when those times are. And so there is no hard and fast rules other than walking with God and studying the Word that will help us through those paths. But I'll just tell you, it is best that we don't change at all unless we have a very, very strong reason to. If you are single and the person who is the ideal husband has asked you to marry him, say yes. Or wife, if the ideal wife has asked you to marry her. If you have the ideal change that's based on the Word of God and everything about it is right, then go for it. Otherwise, what do you want to change for? If you will take care of the current situation that you are in, you will be more happy with your situation and quit looking at everybody else's situation as always better. Now I want to continue this subject a little bit tonight on making our situation not just for ourselves, but for our families better. And I'm speaking to the young people, because some of you older people are beyond hope. Okay, you're set in your ways already, and you are older than me and aren't going to listen anyway. Okay, I'm speaking to the young people so that you know what should be done. And if some of you older people aren't doing the things that you should be, and you do hear something tonight that makes you change, then bless God for it. But I'm gearing for those of you who are young. Don't think that I'm applying this tonight to your parents. I'm putting this on you because it is right now your job to be ordering your life in a biblical manner so that you are going to be the person I'm talking about tonight. That's your job tonight, so that in 10 years from now you are on that path. So in Proverbs chapter 13, I quoted part of this verse last night. In Proverbs chapter 13, it says in verse 22, "A good man leaveth an inheritance to his children's children, and the wealth of the sinner is laid up for the just." A good man leaveth an inheritance to his children's children. Now, I misquoted this a little bit last night, just pulling it out of off the top of my head. I said, I think it says a good man leaves an inheritance to his children. Now, that's the truth. You can't leave an inheritance to your children's children without leaving an inheritance to your children. But it is way further than that in what it means. Because leaving an inheritance to your children doesn't mean you left anything to their children. If you leave an inheritance to your children, it not only means you left them something, but you left them in a way that they were going to take care of it and pass it on. That's what it means. A good man leaveth an inheritance to his children's children. Now, under the law of Moses and in the land of Israel, the way the Israelites lived, when they went into the land, they divided all the land up by families, and each family got a portion of land, and your children lived on that parcel of ground after you, okay? That was how they did it. They never moved. Speak about no change. That was how God ordained Israel to live. So when the children came along, they stayed on the family farm, and when their children came along, they stayed on the family farm, and I'm sure the land that they were given was very large. It wasn't just like a city lot like we live in a lot of times these days. You couldn't do that in America with our city lots because you can't keep building 10 more houses on one small lot that there's only room for one house on. So they had a lot of property, but that was how they did it. And Solomon, in writing or thinking about that situation, he's looking at the fact that somebody can destroy their property. And when the children come along, there isn't much there. They've got to start from the beginning. They've got to maybe redig wells, maybe rebuild fences, replant trees, remake gardens, because the father was a drunkard and he let everything go. And he says, a good man's leaving an inheritance. But of course, when we're reading this verse tonight, we are seeing so much more than the physical things that can be left behind by a father. And we are looking at an inheritance that is incorruptible, that fadeth not away, something reserved in heaven for us. And you say, well, that's from Jesus, isn't it? If you're a man of God, it's from you. You know, all the good things that God has for his children come through God's people. I never got a drink of water from Jesus. He never gave me a drink. But if one of his servants gave me a drink, then Jesus says that servant of his won't lose his reward for it. Everything that we get from God comes from his people. Church is probably the number one key ingredient that we have, where it says we are all members one of another, and we come together, and we come together to edify each other. That's not me edifying you, that's you edifying me too. That means you have to sit there and shake your head yes when I say something. That's edifying. It's the edification of the body that builds up the saints. You say, well, I believe that good things come from God. Good things come from God, but he gives them to his people, and his people pass them on. And generation after generation after generation, we get things from our fathers who were Christians before us. And we learn from them. And we learn about God from them. And we learn to do right from them. And those things build a society. And if you don't have a Christian parent, no problem. You get saved. And you get started immediately with a new life. Then you are joined by the Spirit of God into the church of God, and you have a new family. So, at that point, you're not looking for an inheritance from your father, but you're looking for an inheritance from your leaders at church, or your best friends, or the people that you lived life with. And I want to go to the book of Ruth now. This is my favorite book in the entire Bible, I think. It's a short little book, but it is so extremely powerful in its message. And I want to look at two different men in the book of Ruth. One who left the inheritance to his children that we're talking about tonight, and one who didn't. Okay, Elimelech. Verse 1 says, "Now it came to pass in the days when the judges ruled that there was a famine in the land, and a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to sojourn in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. And the name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife Naomi, and the name of his two sons Mahlon and Chilion, Ephrathites of Bethlehem, Judah. And they came into the country of Moab and continued there. And Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left, and her two sons. And they took them wives of the women of Moab. The name of the one was Orpah, and the name of the other Ruth. And they dwelled there about 10 years. And Mahlon and Chilion died also, both of them, and the woman was left of her two sons and her husband. Then she arose with her daughters-in-law, and that she might return from the country of Moab. For she had heard in the country of Moab how that the Lord had visited his people in giving them bread." All right, this is the amount of stuff that we know about this man called Elimelech. This is what we know about him in these verses right here. He was a man who had two sons and a wife, and a piece of property in Israel that he had inherited from his father. He was that man. He was neighbor to a man called Boaz, who we will also look at. They lived in the same country, same kind of property, right next door to each other. They were relatives. And a famine came to the country. And this is what he said when the famine came. What did he say? "The grass is greener on the other side of the fence." That's what he said. He said, "We're having a struggle right now to keep our farm running." He said, "We're lacking water. We're going to be hungry here. And over there in Moab, some miles away in another country where they don't know God and don't have the Bible and don't listen to what he says, and they live with different gods over there." He didn't say that he didn't think about any of the problems in Moab. He just thought about the fact that they had more water at that time than Israel had. And so he said, "I have a better situation over there." And he said, "I'm going to go over there." And I'm going to make up a story right now. Everything that I said is just, everything I'm going to say about Elimelech is just hypothetical. What is the likely type of thoughts he was having? We don't know exactly what he said, because what I read you is the only thing we know about him. But let's just imagine that he said, "I'm going to Moab." And he sat down with one of the elders from his town and said, "I'm going to Moab." And the elder of his town said, But they don't worship God there. What are you going to do?" And he said, "Well, I don't think it'll be a big deal. We'll be there for a short time and we're returning. We have a problem here we're facing, and God is knowledgeable. He knows there's a famine here, and he knows we're going to have trouble. And he won't care if we go live there for a short time." And his elder says, But God requires of you that you do all these things that are written in the law with the temple worship. There's sacrifices that you're supposed to give every year. There's every year you're supposed to appear before the Lord, and every year you're supposed to do this, and there's feasts that you're supposed to keep, and you're going to be totally alone over there in Moab. There's going to be nobody to fellowship with." But you know what the man thought? He thought it was going to be okay because he was looking at the grass. That was all. He said, "I'm in trouble here. We're having a problem here. If I go there, I'll be okay. I'm not going to do wrong over there. I'll be okay." But the fact of the matter was, he compromised to leave Israel. He did wrong to leave Israel. He did wrong to choose something to eat over the portion that God gave to him. He did wrong. It was sin for him to move. It was wrong because he left something that God gave him for something that was of man. You say, that's hard. That's hard on Elimelech. What? why would it be so, I mean, suppose that he went there and he was a missionary and he saved all the Moabites. You know, the fact of the matter is that the children of Israel were never commissioned to convert the nations around them. Interestingly, I think that God certainly wanted the Moabites converted. And if somebody from Israel had actually wanted to convert them, they would not have had to have left Israel to do it. But you can make a million excuses. The thing of it was, any excuse he made was false. He went there for food. Now I wish he had been reading the Bible. It would have been good if he had been reading and he had opened to Deuteronomy chapter 8 and he had read out of the law where it says, Deuteronomy 8:3, and he humbled thee and suffered thee to hunger. God did that. He humbled thee and suffered thee to hunger. Why would God do that? And fed thee with manna which thou knewest not, neither did thy fathers know, that he might make thee to know that man doth not live by bread only, but by every word that proceedeth out of the mouth of the Lord doth man live. Now, God never said to man that we do not live by bread at all. He said we don't live by bread only. Bread is very important to us. Taking care of ourselves and working and providing for ourselves is important. But it's not the only thing we live by. We also have to live by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God, which means we're going to have to walk the paths of righteousness. And if the paths of righteousness make us hungry one day, we're going to be hungry that day because the word of God comes first and bread comes second. Oftentimes it doesn't work that way in our lives. We choose the things of this world first and listen to God second. And you'll wreck your family every time when you make those choices. But that's what he could have read if he had been paying attention. Sometimes God suffers us to hunger and because he wants us to know that man doesn't live by bread only, but by every word that proceeds out of his mouth. He could have learned that. But I want you to notice something, because what Elimelech did only makes it only becomes crystal clear how wrong Elimelech was after we compare him to Boaz. Now I'll stop here for a second and just mention something else about Elimelech. When Elimelech went to the country of Moab, he died, okay? This is not a scriptural pattern. We do not see that just because a person goes the way that they shouldn't go and makes a choice that they shouldn't make, that they die. It happened in this situation. It may have been God's judgment on him. It may have been God working on Naomi because he wanted Ruth saved, and he saw that this was going to be a way to get his word into Ruth's heart. He may have just been working. We don't know exactly what. But the thing that we do know about this story is Elimelech died, but that isn't necessarily going to be your experience if you walk away from God. Okay, you might live and grow like the green bay tree that it talks about in the Psalms, and everything you do prosper as you work complete wickedness. Right, God has promised judgment to the sinner, but he has not promised immediate judgment. It is appointed unto man once to die, and after that is the judgment. So, Elimelech died. Now, it's also true that both of Elimelech's sons died. So there was three people in this family that died, leaving Naomi by herself in sorrow. Again, it happened in their family. It was a tough life for poor Naomi. And she says when she comes back, "Don't call me Naomi anymore." Naomi was the Hebrew word for pleasant. She said, "Call me Mara," which was the Hebrew word for bitter, because she said that Almighty hath dealt bitterly with me. But I want you to notice something. Elimelech went to the country of Moab to sojourn. How long did he stay there? 10 years. Okay? It was quite a while. Now, you might say in your heart, God, be patient with me. I'm going to get to you in a minute, but just give me a moment. I want to get something done right now. I'm going to do this job that's going to put me in a bad situation. I'm going to do it for a short time. I'll work it for a year. It's going to provide me a ton of money, and I won't let it influence me for bad, and I'm going to get back into a more safe place later. 10 years. You said a year. It's 10 years. He just went to the country of Moab because there was a famine in the land, but the famine kept going and he kept living. But there was more. He said, imagining, when he went to Moab, that his family was going to serve God in Moab. Did they? His two sons both married ungodly women from Moab. This is what I am talking about when I'm talking about the choices that you make affecting your family. You put your family in a situation that they shouldn't be in, and something evil is going to come out of it. And there isn't anything you are going to do to stop it, because you already compromised your spiritual stance to be there in the first place. You already put your family in a place that they don't have anybody to look up to for spiritual leadership. You already trampled on the grass that they were supposed to inherit. You already messed their lives up, and now they marry the women of Moab, which was strictly forbidden in Scripture. Now, Ruth gets gloriously saved later in the book, but she wasn't at this time. Orpah never turns to the Lord. So that was Elimelech. Now, what about Boaz? Boaz is a near relative of Elimelech. He's living in Israel at the same time Elimelech is. What happened when Elimelech left Israel to go to Moab? Boaz didn't. He was there when Naomi returned. What did Boaz do for a living? Farming. He farmed. He had double trouble. So the nation of Israel is experiencing a drought. His trade is being a farmer. Now, we can also guess that the nation of Israel will also be experiencing some sort of recession. Economy's down. Everything's down. Now, if you ever wanted to be a farmer in the worst situation that you could possibly be in anywhere, be a farmer in a drought during a recession. There is nobody on the face of the earth that could ask for a fence with less grass. That's the bottom. That was where Boaz was. And I want you to listen to what the Bible says about Boaz. Verse 1 of chapter 2. And Naomi had a kinsman of her husband's, a mighty man of wealth, of the family of Elimelech, and his name was Boaz. Somebody come up here and tell me how Elimelech had to leave the country because things were too poor for him to stay there. And during those 10 years of famine, Boaz either maintained or became a mighty man of wealth, being a farmer in a drought-stricken country. Tell me how he did it. There's only one answer. There's only one answer. It is the simplest answer on the face of the earth, and every single person sitting in this room is able to do it. He just kept doing it and didn't quit. That was the only thing he had to do, was keep on when other people quit. He had two choices. He could follow Elimelech to Moab, or he could keep doing it. He didn't have any magic wand that he could wave at the clouds. He didn't get more rain on his property than Elimelech would have if he had stayed. He didn't have anything at all going for him. He had the same disastrous situation that Elimelech would have been in, but he had something else because I bet you anything that he was reading the Bible or he was listening to it and he found something written in there that he said, that said, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceedeth out of the mouth of God. He says, God suffered them to hunger, our relatives in the past. He suffered them to hunger so that he could teach them some things. And he probably sat down with his wife and he probably said, I wonder what God wants us to learn. Because whatever it is, I want to learn it. And his wife said, honey, can we leave? I don't know if we're going to get a crop this year. How are we going to eat? And he said, if we die on this property, we aren't leaving. Because this is where God put us and I'm staying here. It says he was a mighty man. Mighty men don't run from situations. Mighty men stick it out and overcome situations. So do mighty women. Now, Boaz, you guys all know the story, and he ends up, he's in harvest time when Naomi returns with Ruth, who's newly dedicated her life to God. She's now said, your God is going to be my God and your people my people. I'm going back to the land of Israel with you and I'm living there with you. I'm serving your God. And so she's come back with Naomi and it's in the harvest time. But only this year was different from the previous 10 years. Because this year, the drought had ended and he had amazing harvest. And everything was amazing. But it wasn't that year that made him a mighty man of wealth. It was the previous 10 years that had made him a mighty man of wealth. That was the only way he made it. It was the previous 10 years that had made him his wealth. And so it ends up that Ruth ends up marrying this man Boaz according to the law. It was because her husband, one of the two sons of Elimelech, had been her husband. He had died. She hadn't had any children yet. And so it was, so she was supposed to marry a near relative and produce a son that would become the heir of Elimelech's property. And so she was producing a son so Elimelech would have somebody to inherit his land with Boaz. And how many of you guys can tell me what the book of Ruth is about? You don't have to say. Do you know what the book of Ruth is about? Is the book of Ruth here to tell us about the sin of Elimelech? The prosperity of Boaz? The good way that God's trouble in the life of Naomi ended up finally blessing her? Or is it just about the beautiful girl from Moab named Ruth? You know what the book of Ruth is about? It's not about any of these people, though we get great insight from their lives. The book of Ruth isn't about these people. The book of Ruth is about Jesus. Because when you go to the end of the book of Ruth and you find out why is God telling us the things he's telling us here about this, he says in verse 17, and the woman, her neighbors gave it a name. This is the son that Ruth and Boaz had together. The women, her neighbors gave it a name saying, there's a son born to Naomi. And they called his name Obed. He is the father of Jesse, the father of David. We don't need to know anything about David tonight. We're not being told something here in this book about David because God wants us to be history smart about David. Everything that we read in the Old Testament is teaching us of God and his Christ. And David, it just so happened, was going to possess the promises of God that was going to be his seed, that was going to sit on the throne of Israel forever. And the promised Messiah, the king who was going to reign over the entire earth, was going to come of David's seed. Now, remember our verse? A good man leaveth an inheritance to his children's children. Okay, so what did Boaz do? He left an inheritance of the serving of God to David and to Solomon. Obed was his son, but Obed wasn't the father of David. Obed was the father of Jesse. And Jesse is the father of David. And David is the man after God's own heart. Where do you think David? He's a teenager out in the wilderness, taking care of sheep, when the nation of Israel, for the most part, doesn't know a lot about God and is doing their own thing their own way. There's a lot of trouble, there's a lot of war, there's a lot of everything wrong in the nation. And David is writing and singing psalms out there with the sheep, and he is passionately in love with God. Where did David get that from? Boaz, who spent 10 years of famine serving God, becoming a mighty man of wealth, not physically, just physically, though he did get wealthy physically, but spiritually. He passed something spiritual on down through the generations. And God's looking at this and he's saying, I know just exactly how history is going to come out. You know, he's already made his promises. He made his promises to Adam and Eve about Christ. He made his promises to Abraham. Now we're hundreds of years past Adam and Eve when he makes promises to Abraham. And he says that it's going to be Abraham's seed that is going to bless all the nations of the earth. And then some time past Abraham, he makes promises about Judah, saying that it's going to be Judah's seed. Now Judah is removed from Abraham a couple of generations, and he says it's going to be Judah's seed that I'm going to bring my Christ through. And so now we know there's 12 tribes of Israel, and Judah is the one we're looking at, because Judah, the promises are narrowing down to a smaller and smaller group of people. And so somebody from Judah's line, God knows all along there's going to be a David, and God's going to say to David that it is going to be of his seed that he is going to bring his Christ. God knows what he's doing. But in this story, we're in the days when the judges ruled, when things were a disaster all over, all the time in Israel, where this one man, Elimelech, he chose to go live where the world was instead of where the people of God were. He lost everything in his family. And Boaz, who chose to live where the people of God was and the famine was, became a mighty man of wealth and becomes himself and Ruth get themselves into this line of producing the Christ. Grass is always greener on the other side of the fence when we are looking at things from the wrong perspective. But when we are looking at things from God's perspective, the most important thing that we understand is that we do not ever, ever, ever want to make a change in our life that pulls us away from anything of God to put us towards anything of the world. You say, but it's so insignificant. I mean, I'm going to make this little change from this job or this city where I live to this job in that city. I'm gonna change from this church to that church, and it's like nothing's different. I'm gonna be the same person in either place. But somebody comes to you and they warn you and they say, "But what are you gonna do in this? What are you gonna do in this? What are you gonna do in this?" I've seen it over and over and over. I've seen it again and again and again. You make a change in your life because something from the world appeals to you, and you give up just a little itty bit of something that you were holding on to in Christianity to do it. And from there on, it's a walk downhill. Over and over and over and over it happens. Most of the time, the person taking the steps doesn't know they're doing it. I told you I was going to give you some stories tonight. I want to talk to you about some situations, some specific situations, and just get you to think for a minute. You know, the Bible we're reading, a good man leaves an inheritance to his children's children. Now just think for a minute with me about my family. My mom, my mom's side of the family, comes from Lower Michigan. My mom's mother and father lived there in a little town in Litchfield, and they were farmers and worked a couple jobs besides. They had a farm, and that farm was my grandpa's father's, I believe, right there. So I believe he grew up there, is my understanding, either that or the next one over. I might have a detail mixed up, but I believe he grew up in that house. And so my grandpa lived there all his life. And my grandma obviously would have joined him when they got married and lived there most of her life. And she's still living there. In fact, my grandma is doing everything in her power to ensure that she does not pass any inheritance down to anybody because she's going to outlive them. She's now in her mid-90s and still living on her own, and she doesn't care about passing down inheritance. She just wants to stay alive. Fine. Okay. So, but my what my grandma has right now, what she's got left that she might pass down to her children, of which she has two, a son and a daughter. What she has left to pass down is a house that I'm just going to make a guesstimate. It's worth $150,000 to $200,000, perhaps, and she's got two children, about nearing 70 or something like that. And they've already lived their life, already done their things, already worked for what they've gotten. And what does the Bible mean when it says a good man leaveth an inheritance to his children's children? What are they ever going to get out of her that is going to be worth anything? She's probably going to end up in a nursing home and live 10 more years, and the nursing home's going to get her house anyway. And, you know, there's nothing there. It's happening all over our country right now. There are so few people passing anything down to their children, it's not even funny these days. By the time people get to their old age and they die, what they have left is of so little value, and their children have already lived so long on their own, they don't need anything anyway, and half the time the nursing home gets it. Okay, so that's my mom's side. Now, if my mom ever does inherit anything from her grandma, I guarantee she's going to live on it, because she's a poor woman too. She's going to live on it. She's got seven kids to divide it up for. If she has anything left when she dies, she's not going to have anything left. My mom doesn't own anything right now of any major value, and she's got seven kids. What's she going to pass down to her children? We'll take my dad's side. On my dad's side, my grandpa and grandma lived in that little house next to the TV station just down from Golden Harvest. I don't know at what point they came there, but when they were young, they built the house a room at a time, all by themselves. I'm sure they never owed a penny to anybody for it. My grandpa was not a hardworking man. He was somewhat lazy. And in fact, I remember going into the upper story of his little rundown garage there and finding a sign. He was a sign painter, and there was a sign in there, and it said, "Signs while you wait and wait and wait." So that's who my grandpa was. He had a basement so full of stuff. He had boxes stacked in his basement along every wall and all over the center, with aisles this big to walk between. He knew what was in them all. They were all labeled. They were old Coke boxes, and he had every one of them full. And he spent all day in his basement, unless maybe he went fishing. And he called it puttering. He went down there to putter. And who knows what he did. He just stayed in his basement and played with stuff. He you know what? He died. That's pretty normal. He died. Left everything to his wife. And not too long after that, she ends up, a stroke, I think, and she ends up in the nursing home, and she ends up dying, and the house is sold for a whopping beautiful $40,000, and the nursing home got it all. And that's how we leave inheritance to our children. And so My mom and dad haven't gotten anything yet from their mom and dad, and it's very unlikely that they're going to ever have anything that they're going to pass on to me. What does it mean? What does the Bible mean when it says a good man leaves an inheritance to his children's children? Now, I'll tell you what. There are some people that become wealthy and do actually pass down money to their children and hardworking people, and that's fine. And I think that some of what Solomon was talking about was included in that verse, but I'm going to tell you something different. Because my dad didn't spend his life working for the things of this world. He spent his entire life working as little as he had to make the money that he needed to survive so that he could spend his time leaving an inheritance to his children's children. Because Christianity around him was going wrong. And he was doing everything in his power to preach the word and to write and to teach and to help some soul stabilize so that the waves that were sweeping over the churches taking everybody out, he was looking to try to save something. By the time I was 15 years old, it finally clicked with me what my dad was all about. And I fell in love with the Bible. And I started reading. And I realized the value of what he had spent his life doing. And I don't know if I'm good. I'm probably not good enough to love it as much as he loved it. I struggled with my dad a little bit when I was growing up. He was kind of a tough, somewhat hard to please kid. I struggled with our church a little bit. I believed everything. I believed everything my dad taught. I believed what the church was doing. But you know, we were maybe about 20 people meeting week after week after week after week with very little life in the church. There wasn't much there. And I looked out over other churches that I wouldn't be happy at if I was there today. I looked out over other churches and there was things happening. You saw things going on. There was people and there was energy. And I wondered what I was supposed to do with myself. And I said, This was all the things that worked in my heart at the time. I said, I don't see myself ever leaving the church here and saying, I don't agree with this church, I want to go somewhere else. I said, I don't ever see myself doing that. But somehow, I want to find something to do that's bigger than what this is. That's what I was thinking in my head. I want to find something to do that is bigger than this. You know what? God didn't call most of us to do big things, especially idiots. But I'll tell you one thing that he called every single person in this room to do. He called you to stay where you are and take care of the things that he entrusted to you. I could talk about Dale tonight. He's sitting here to listen. He'll probably come and complain later. I could talk about the inheritance that Nikki's going to get from her mom and dad. I don't think it's going to be much. You know, Dale spent many, many, many years working at Marplex. And he got enough money from his job to support his family. And that was it. They didn't get anything. They don't have anything from this life. He's got to be getting close to 90 now. And I don't know how old he is, honestly. I'm not sure. He's an old man now, and he's in debt for his house. You know what Dale's going to leave to his children when he dies? I hope you live for a long time, Dale. You know what he might leave with his children when he dies? Is a debt. No. No. Because he gave them something else that was what God wanted him to give, because he gave them a lifelong commitment of showing that a man can stay doing the same thing over and over and over and over again, being faithful to a church that wasn't growing, being faithful to the Word of God, standing for the Word when his family was laughing at him, standing for the Word when his friends were laughing at him, standing for the Word when it left him a poor man. He gave his children that. That's what he gave them. A good man leaves an inheritance to his children's children. That's what Boaz did. He left an inheritance that passed down to Jesse, to David, to Solomon. And you know what happened? You can go check this out for yourself. Somehow Solomon failed. And his son became a fool. And you know, Jesus didn't come from Rehoboam. The Jesus that God had promised was going to come of the seed of David, that was going to reign forever and ever and ever. That Jesus didn't come from Solomon. It came from David. The line did not carry on where the line of the kings carried on from so many years. It didn't carry on through Solomon. It carried on through other of David's children, where Christ came. I used to struggle with my business. I got it in my head when I was 24 years old that I could do anything in the world. I had it in my head that I could do anything in the world when I was 15. And God had already showed me once that I couldn't when I was about 18, when he really brought me down. And by the time I was 24, I knew I wasn't worth anything spiritually, but I thought I was still worth something physically. I thought I could still do anything I wanted in this world, and so I was going to start a business. And I had it all laid out, exactly how it was going to work. We had numbers from other companies, and we said, if we can just make $800 a day, we'll be wealthy. $800 a day in sales was all it would take to make us wealthy. Well, we made $200 a day for the first 2 years in business. It paid rent and electricity, and we worked for free. And, actually what really happened was I worked construction, and my friend who started the business with me worked at the store, and I paid her out of my check. And we split my check, so I got $10 an hour and $12 an hour, depending on which year it was. Let's say I was working at $10 an hour and I worked 40 hours a week and she worked 40 hours a week and we split, so we got $5 an hour. That was good pay. And it didn't see, the store had no energy at all. It didn't seem like we could do anything right. We had very few customers and nothing really worked. But I still kind of believed that I could do anything. And so when we parted ways, me and the partner who had started it with us, we parted ways. I took over the whole store. I bought her out. And we moved the building. We moved the store into a different building. We had to move. And so we moved into a different building. The rent was higher. I quit my job. And I went full-time at the store. I had the belief in my heart that I could do it. I didn't have my belief in God. I had the belief in my heart that I could do it. Pretty dumb. Pretty dumb. I mean, you look at me, you might think I'm intelligent, but history didn't show us. History did not show us that I was intelligent. Nothing I did worked. And for the next 5 years of my life, I don't think a day went by that I didn't question whether or not it was God's will that I get rid of the store. Now, of course, why did I think it might be God's will? Because the grass was greener on the other side of the fence. I could have gone and gotten a job at McDonald's and made more money. Now, I wasn't reading the Bible and, oops, it says, thou shalt not own a golden harvest. No, I wasn't getting anything from God that made me think that maybe it wasn't God's will for me to own the store. It just wasn't doing anything. After years of just pouring my life into it, and you know, I mean, I'm not talking, I mean, I'm really talking, I really worked. There were days we got up at 4 o'clock in the morning, we went to the store and physically worked hard labor for an hour loading a pickup and a trailer with stuff. went up to a flea market and sat and baked in the sun at 80 degrees, came back at about, got back at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, had to unload everything in the truck. And then after everything was done, it's 5 o'clock in the afternoon, we've already put in our 13 hours and we're going to stay and work at the store for another 6 to catch things up at the store that need to be done. And you work those kind of hours and struggle to pay every bill that you pay, drive a car that is falling to pieces, have nothing to your name and don't know how you could ever find a dime of money to be made out of the business, you want to quit. I don't doubt for a moment that Boaz had those moments when he worked for 10 years with the famine raging in Israel when Elimelech had moved off. He probably said Elimelech was right a few times. But he became a mighty man of wealth because he stuck with what he was doing. I don't know if I should tell this story. I feel like this isn't necessarily a public story, but I feel like I'm going to share it because I think it tells something about the end of a story. After 20 years of running a business that I have consistently worked 80 hours a week and I have not gotten a raise for 10 years. Since the day I started paying myself a salary, I have not given myself a raise in those 10 years. I'm still somewhat poor. I have given some money to the work of the Lord over the years. I've never kept track of how much it was. If I had kept everything that I gave away, I'd probably have my house paid for. But except for the fact that if I had not given those things away, I probably would have been very much less blessed of God than I have been. And I probably would be in the hospital instead of having my house paid off or something else. You can't pick what God's going to do to you when He wants to get you face to face with Him and He wants you to serve Him first. You just never know what God's going to do. But I shared this with some of you guys earlier. There a lot through a long, long story here of taking care of a family in need and trying to help them for months, and it seemed like things just came together. We had been looking for a couple of years at building a store down in Merrill, and it just, everything we looked at was fell apart. There were promises made to us. We couldn't jump in at the right time. Someone else came, took the property we were looking at. They said, "No big deal. We've got other property over here. We'll work with you on." But the next year later, that wasn't going to happen for many years. They said it wasn't turning out, and nothing just seemed to work out. And then all of a sudden, it was just like God opened a door, and Lord willing, there we should be breaking ground within the next 30 days down in Merrill to build a new store the same size as the one in Rhinelander, at which the city of Merrill is giving me and Nikki a lot plus TIF money equaling to $655,000. Now, this is the first time in my entire life that anything like this has ever happened to me. But I can tell you, I've worked for 20 years, every day for 20 years. And if I had quit on any one of those days, there was no way that could happen. You cannot ever get to a place where you get something unless you worked to get to that place. And I am here. This is my advice for every young person. The pursuit that you can give to yourself by pushing yourself forward in the things of this life, by changing, by taking this instead of that, and then this instead of that, and then this instead of that. I'm going to climb this ladder. It will never get you to the same place that staying in the path of God's will get you. If you if you do become wealthy out of it, if you don't become wealthy out of it, if you get something out of it, if your business goes well, if it doesn't go well, the thing that we want is something that we can pass on to our children. And you can't pass the world on to them unless you want to lose their souls. Now I could quickly tell you the rest of the story. I mean, it is true that the city of Merrill is giving us in the equivalent of $655,000. We're also taking on $3 million worth of debt from the bank. So it's kind of like really in reality we're going behind $2.5 million instead of getting ahead $600,000. I mean, it's the way business works, and it's not like I'm all of a sudden going to have $600,000 to say, what am I going to do with this? I mean, the $455,000 value of the lot I can't touch for 25 years until my loan is paid off. You know, that's just collateral on the loan. And the other money is going to be eaten up by my employees down there to get the business started, so I ain't going to see that either. But I'm not telling this story to illustrate the fact that you should stick with something because it might make you rich. I'm telling you this story to illustrate the fact that people who stick with something eventually can do it. It doesn't matter what it is. It doesn't matter if your name is Boaz and you're in a famine. You can do it if you stick with it. If you quit. We can go back to last night. Grass is greener on the other side of the fence. When should we change? God doesn't say that it's wrong to change your jobs. He does say it's wrong to change your wife. He doesn't say it's wrong to change your location of living. He doesn't say it's wrong to go to a different church. But generally speaking, when we read about change in the scriptures, it's always for the worse. It's usually what we find. The people who are apt to change, it's for the worse. And he says, meddle not with them that are given to change. The people who always want something different, he says, don't have anything to do with them. Those people will never serve God. Because as we know, God doesn't change. Christianity doesn't change. The things that belong in church don't change. The things that our fathers did, the things that built the country of the United States of America that our Christian fathers did, those things don't change. We don't need anything different. We don't need anything contemporary. We don't need anything that's up to date. We want to stay with old-fashioned biblical religion that has nothing in man and everything in Jesus. I'm talking to a whole bunch of people here who have no clue what I'm talking about. Because when you look with your eyes on the situations of life, there's going to be 100 times you're going to look at something and it's going to make perfect sense that situation is way better than the one you're in. And it just might not be the truth most of the time. It might be sometimes, and don't hesitate to change if the change was pushed on you by something from God. But if it's the flesh pushing you, stay where you are. If you've got something in your life that isn't right, if you're in a situation where you can't feel like you can build an inheritance for your family, where you can't be comfortable, where there isn't a church, get out. Go do something that's of God. Those are the kind of change which we should be pursuing, is something that's of God. But the changes that will elevate us potentially in this world, we need to be very careful and shy of them and make sure that there's never to be any compromise at all to take that path before we make a change. A good man leaves an inheritance to his children's children. I have been left an inheritance from my father, something that very, very, very many people have never been given. I've been left an inheritance from my father that's worth more than all the gold in this world. And if the Lord will help me, I'll pass that on to my children's children. But I'm going to have to make some decisions that are focused on that and not anything else in this world if I'm going to make that happen. I think we're going to have to take a break here, about 15 more minutes until the next meeting.